That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
It's always had a bit of a Hollywood script to it. An abandoned chocolate factory turned into a thriving production line of controversial product, which might make one crave chocolate after consumption. The movie could be also a biopic of Bruce Linton's life, or at least the stage in this life when he built Canopy Growth, one of the biggest publicly traded cannabis companies in the world. Rewind less than a decade, and this wasn't an easy conversation to have around a boardroom table. Of course, there's a journey of several twisted forks in the road that led to this opportunity, scarier than most of us would be willing to venture on. But Bruce, a graduate of Carleton University, hopped on board, almost like a magic carpet. And wow, did he ever fly. He traveled and we marveled at what he was able to accomplish until some of the magic died. I'm not sure why I make the comparison of Bruce's entrepreneurship reign to an elite athlete, but I do. At the top of one's game, only to be traded or even worse, maybe sent down to the minors. But Bruce was fired not long ago from his post as CEO, but like any true champion, you find your way back to the top, and it seems Bruce has been very quick to rebound. This is going to be one wild ride, so buckle in. And welcome to Living Your Life with Leanne Lang, the podcast brought to you by Extension Marketing. And of course, for more information, you can always head to extensionmarketing.com. Bruce, I'm really excited to have you here.
Well, I'm glad we bumped into each other socially and you nabbed me.
I did. I was like, this is a perfect story, I think, especially here in the city. We are so familiar with your name. But the more research I did, the more I was talking to people and looking at things, your name, it's on a world spectrum. I mean, we know it here in Ottawa, but this company, what you have done has made world headlines.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people in Canada realize part of the reason Canopy and Tweed and by default me as the sort of founder became global is because Canada has the best, most advanced way of looking at how to manage cannabis, how to create science outcomes. And so when the Germans say, well, what should we do? They followed a lot of the Canadian practices and the first product came from Canopy. Denmark, same thing. If you go to Poland, products listed there for medical applications come from Canopy in Canada. And so by default of pushing it, you end up showing up and trying to influence these things. Last week I was in Jamaica and it was quite interesting. Before I left Canopy, I was the chairman of a Jamaican cannabis company. And, I would say that I'm the keynote speaker at Jamaican cannabis conferences where part of what they need is to get over the topic that is cannabis and say, okay, now that we're going to regulate, educate, and monetize, because that's what government should do. So they're not making it fun. Nobody wants to have fun. That's not what governments want us to do. But they don't want to see these active ingredients left to the illicit market. They want them regulated. And once you think it through once or twice or five times, you can go to a place like Jamaica and you'd say, well, Jamaica probably has a lot of cannabis. They don't have that much of great quality and they have a great system now for a regulated market. And so I'm at this conference and I do my keynote presentation and this guy from Ottawa, Canada, can actually give input that probably will change how economics work in their 14 parishes. So Jamaica is not Jamaica. Jamaica is made up of 14 kind of like provinces or states. And my pitch to the people listening, including government officials, was that rather than market Jamaica, rather than market Marley, they should make it so that their products are grown in each of the provinces, all 14. And that the people selling the products, what happens is you get off the ship in Jamaica, you go into a store, the dispensary, and there's a doctor or someone there who can certify that you're sick, which means for the course of your vacation, you can have cannabis and the government gets taxes and it's regulated. And the reason they're doing it that way is if they made it recreational, they would upset America and they'd have a problem with banking. So they do it that way. And then what I propose is that when you go to those dispensaries, the spots where you'll buy the cannabis, that 25% of all the products sold had to come from in equal proportion, each of the 14 parishes. And that meant that the genetics had to be targeted to them. The product would be growing there so that the tourists who were largely, you go to Jamaica and as a tourist, what you do is you go into a resort and just stay there. You never leave. But what if they really like the product, say from one of the parishes called Portland, what they might say is, how do I get to Portland? And so the person who's in that area that grew it would get 50% of the net profit of what sold. So they'd make money. But the municipal area would make money because tourists would venture out and want to go see a tour of the growing platform. And the effect of this is that you get economic sprinklings through the whole country. And because of having started in Canada and having created Canopy, I had some credibility when expressing this, which really, I thought of it as sort of like, if everybody who's a past participant who's been punished in Jamaica got to be part of those parishes doing it, there's a certain amount of social justice, there's a certain amount of rebalancing, and there's a certain amount of just be smart, right? Make this a national thing, because it already, stereotypically, you say Jamaica, I say pot.
Right.
Reggae.
Right.
So now manage that. So I would say, yeah, I think Canada, Canopy, and me are internationally known because we had the advantage of being the best first organized place.
Well, that's interesting, because you go on this story and all of a sudden I'm looking at, you know, international diplomacy and government regulations and recreational and travel and tourism. And you look at all of the industry, and I realized at one point we were just talking beforehand, you know, I mentioned the word 14 billion and you said, well, that's 20 billion Canadian. When you look at what this company has been able to be like on the market and the conversations that you're having and you look back, like, you know, less than a decade ago, and you're sitting around a boardroom table being dismissed by bankers and by companies going, you're insane. What are you talking about?
Well, this topic is, it's accelerated so much, right? Like the public policy in Canada began in 2001. You know, they had a federal program for medical, but really they had no organized supply chain, meaning that the patients couldn't really get a regulated product. So it was really 2013 when it began. And so it was about sort of 6 years from the time the public policy hit till I was out. And in that 6 year window, the company was able to go from me walking around by myself to about 4,500 people, and from one location in Canada to 10, and from one country to 16, and from zero patents to over 100 issued. And so I think that was a good startup phase. But for your world and for your listeners, I think what they're going to be really interested in is what I would call Cannabis 3.0. So 1.0 was startup, grow some cannabis, ship it to people, they get it, it's consistent and safe. What's it do? Don't know. You decide. 2.0 is what starts in January of this year in Canada, where the products made are sophisticated for recreational consumers, and there won't be something in the illicit market equal. So the problem the illicit market will have is that they can't compete on price with something they don't have. And so it'll mean that people start going to the stores. And, I think they'll go to these stores for a bunch of reasons, different products. But what's going to start happening is places like New Brunswick and Newfoundland are going to start having coffee shops in the morning and cannabis consumption shops in the afternoon. And the place won't allow you to smoke because you can't smoke anywhere in Canada. I'm not even sure why we sell cigarettes. There's nowhere to smoke. But they'll be able to have a beverage with cannabis in it. And it'll become a social platform where people interact, talk about art, talk about their interests. But it won't have the problem of the drunk, loud guy. It will have a totally different social environment. And nobody's going to...
vibe.
Yeah, and it'll have a vibe. And guess what? You're going to like them because you'll have... it will allow you to have fun and you will absorb zero incremental calories. So, like, that sounds okay. The other part you'll like about it is... there's a very low drug-on-drug interaction, unlike alcohol. And I think the final thing is that they're not dehydration. They're not...
So you're talking about the morning after that horrible hangover that some of us experience?
So you're not going to have... Let's see. You're not going to have a hangover. You're not going to be fatter. And if you're taking other pharmaceutical products, they should be fine. And so I think that will mean the cohort of people who can actually go and socialize with these beverages in these places that start doing it are pretty interesting people. And I think they're going to be a little older than when you go to the bar. And so I think it's going to change society because you change the ingredients and then you change the regulation. And all of a sudden, you know, who the hell wants to buy a coffee at 2 in the afternoon unless you want to be still doing stuff at 12? So I think it's just going to be very interesting and all led by Canada.
What was the 3.0 version?
So 3.0 is when someone who's, say, suffering social anxiety, they have a sleep problem, they can't fall asleep or they can't stay asleep, They have diminished mobility. They have Parkinson's, and they can't cure Parkinson's, but they want the patient to feel better in the morning, less anxious through the day, and sleep better. So 3.0 is when the clinical trials, phase 2B, which means a type of trial, capture enough data to say this combination of ingredients delivered in this way results in 7 hours of this type of quality of sleep. Or this type of ingredient brought this way through an inhalation platform means that the person with Parkinson's in the morning can get to their maximum mobility in a third of the time they would have had if they took other pharmaceutical products or other things of that nature. So 3.0 is when people will be able to say, and maybe other ingredients involved, they'll be able to say, this is what's working for me to feel better. And 4.0 is if it happens when you start to use cannabinoids as curative substances. And that's way out there. But if you take a little tray of stem cells and you have them interact with cannabinoids, it appears that you cause them to behave differently, to respond differently. And so if over time the curative outcome happens, I think it's going to be at a very basic level and we'll start focusing on things like maybe tumors. But, you know, you got to think about 5 or 10 years out if you actually want to have a future. And I think 4.0 is people should be sprinkling money into other curative attributes when used in certain delivery mechanisms with or without other medications. And I think that'll be quite a curious thing to understand.
I think it's interesting for people to have these conversations because we're still looking at it from two, I feel, different perspectives. One is the recreational side. One is the medical side. I know with Canopy Growth, there was the spectrum aspect and really looking at the medicinal way. And I don't know what the proper conversation is as to how you open the conversation for a lot of people, but it's part of the conversation now, especially with demographics that I don't think we're looking at consuming weed or, you know, marijuana in other forms, but are saying, I'm in pain. I'm going to try this CBD oil, or I do have the anxiety. This is, you know, a sprinkle they're seeing benefits. And so it's opening up a dialogue to people, I think, who weren't talking about it before.
Yeah, I think the only people in Canada, there's only one group who should not like cannabis being regulated by the government. Everyone else, like the almost all the population except for a small group, is the criminals who currently make all the money by the illicit market. Everyone else should like the regulation of cannabis. You don't have to buy any, but you shouldn't want the illicit market to make it. And then they should say, I want the government to sponsor science. Because if we're going to regulate it, we need to know what it does. How can you educate people if you don't know what it does? And I think I have yet to meet anybody who thought they were opposed to cannabis regulation, opposed to cannabis, never want to buy it, who after the period of a very brief conversation hadn't changed their mind. And all I have to say is, well...
But that's what you've been doing, Bruce. You've been doing, you've been changing people's minds from the day you started to canvas and to go out and speak to businesses about getting this company going.
Well, what you see is in every country, the same stupid thing occurs. Sick patients, typically a child, often with some form of seizure, end up having to fight in the media with the governing authority. Doesn't matter if it's England, Australia, they have to fight in order to get access to something that diminishes their symptoms. And I can tell you, if you're an elected person and you fight with sick people in the media for extended period of times, you don't win the next election. It just looks like you're heartless. And so it's becoming even more heartless as you see 30 plus countries governing this in a way that's actually intended to give reasonable access. And the reason Canada started in 2001 was not that a politician said this is a good idea. A court said there are medicinal benefits from this plant. And we have a charter of rights that says you cannot withhold medicines from Canadians that would benefit them. So quit doing it. And they had to quit because when the court tells you, the reality is you have to obey. And I think it was a generally bad day for people at Health Canada and the government because they then didn't know what to do. And they took a path that took them more than a decade to arrive at a reasonable platform. And they're still working on it. But the potential of this thing, like everybody talks about CBD and THC. Which are funny things. Like it's like walking up to your pharmacist and saying, these are the ingredients I would like you to use to make me feel better. No one does that. What they do is they see their doctor or their pharmacist and they describe their ailment and someone with some knowledge puts together a combination of ingredients that diminishes the symptoms or relieves the issue. In cannabis, people still feel like they're experts. They all want to say CBD, THC. Those are two of 140 ingredients inside the plant.
Just two out of 140.
Right. And people say, well, it's CBD. It doesn't have a psychoactive effect. Well, it does. What it doesn't do is make you have a high in terms of having a different perception in terms of that kind of high. But the reason,
like an altered state.
Right. So, but CBD affects your brain. If it diminishes anxiety, that has had a psychoactive effect because you're not anxious in your toe, right? You're anxious in your brain. And people say, well, it's only CBD. If you actually do a drug on drug profile, which is where you take CBD, you put in these petri dishes and you see whether or not it interacts with a variety of other drugs, I think most people will conclude that CBD actually is a bit more frisky, has a lot more action with other drugs than THC. THC is the one which causes the high, the, you know, changed psychoactive state. It actually is less drug on drug. And if people want to sleep, they'll find that CBD doesn't actually make them sleep. Maybe they think it makes them sleep, but it doesn't. They have to have combinations of THC and CBD to get there. And so what's going to happen over time is people are going to start getting to the point where they say, you know what, like benzodiazepines and sleep aids of that nature are pretty horrible, right? They have a diminishing return over time. You have to take more and more. They don't result in a great sleep. And so people are going to start to say, well, maybe I should try that. And once they do try it, the combination is scientifically tested. I think the big losers are people who make Ambien, as an example. And so I think that this whole, how does it work is changing. And so part of the reason I got involved in another company now that's involved with psychoactives, you know, you say, oh my God, Bruce, what the heck? You're a drug dealer, like cannabis. Mm-hmm. Now you're talking about Ibogaine and LSD and ketamine and all these things. Well, I think anybody who bans anything without a good reason and good knowledge is probably prejudiced. And prejudice doesn't often arise out of super smart people. And so a lot of these things have experienced prejudice without the fact base of why. And so there's probably massive therapeutic. If something could help diminish suicidal thoughts, would you be in favor of it? Yes. Well, what if it's currently prohibited? Well, if you run it therapeutically, you'd still say yes. What if this could help people with addictions to things, get them off better than anything else? Would you be in favor of that? Yes. Well, what if it's currently prohibited? Well, still try it. So if you use the logic of can I help society in a governed way, most people say yes. But if you say, hey, do you want to have a party with LSD? Not as many people in favor of that. And so I think there's just going to be a whole management of policy and perception that captures a whole bunch of things. I'm not saying there's going to be an LSD party. There shouldn't be. But therapeutically, why are we banning it? Why are we banning, you know, all of these sort of category of products that if in the right dosage and the right care environment actually cause people to have a positively altered state without a repercussion equivalent to the other pharmaceuticals, I think we're in favor.
You have the research, you have the understanding behind you. Like you've educated yourself on knowing, I didn't even know there was 2 out of 140 ingredients, yeah. Right? There's a difference as to what we've been exposed to,
yeah.
And what's actually being done.
Yeah. And, you know, if you're ever going to be an investor, you should never invest where there's symmetrical information between you and everyone else. Because you just can't win, right? If everybody knows all the same stuff at the same time, mm-hmm. then there's no chance you're actually going to have any advantage. But if there's asymmetrical information where perception is negative and facts may not be, then you should go do that. And so I look at these things as I'm not for or against them, but I'm curious enough to want to see if there's a way to turn them into something. And most people's bias keeps them away. Like if I walked up to you and said, you know, I have a really terrific business and we're going to be using a lot of Special K, that's the street name for ketamine, and we're going to have a lot of LSD and stuff. 99% of institutional investors and retail people will say no. But if you walked up to them and said, we might in fact be able to invert certain medical outcomes that could be managed clinically better, back to the, you know, depression, PTSD, all the, would you like to invest in that? Do you think there's a big addiction problem if we have a solution? You say, yeah. So it's how do you position these things in your own mind before the bias takes over?
Is that where the pivot came years back when you had to actually convince banks and board members and people to get on board initially with Canopy?
This podcast is brought to you by Extension Marketing. They are a new breed of marketing agency that acts as your virtual marketing department, designing and implementing cost-effective marketing strategies that will grow your business. I can speak to this personally, as I've been using the Extension Marketing team to help me launch and grow my business. Founder Pat Whalen has been a lifesaver for me, a genuine coach guiding me along the way into uncharted territory. Tell them you're a friend of the show and receive a free one-hour consultation. Check them out at extensionmarketing.com.
I was, when I started what was called Tweet at the time, I almost did it on a whim. right? Like, I was like, why not?
Well, I read a quote somewhere that you like taking on things that could be disastrous.
Well, I think
that it's almost, you know, like there has to be a massive consequence for you to put the risk and for you to put your energy, I'm thinking, towards something to make successful.
Well, I think it causes you to be motivated, right? Like, in this city, there's one person who's outrageous in doing this, and a lot of people get down on him. So we had a guy who tried to take a research heart from the Heart Institute and make it so you could have an implanted heart instead of a heart that never needed to be cut out for like a decade. And it kind of worked, but it didn't wholly work. It was called, you know, Rod Brydon's whole process in that one. And people are like, oh, that didn't work. You shouldn't, as if you shouldn't try it. I think it's actually, why would you try something that like is like making version 16 of something that exists? Isn't it more interesting to make something kind of outlandish? So I was attracted to Rod because of his pursuit of outlandish things. And like his idea of, we're not going to put garbage in a big pile and make a hill out of it. We're going to put garbage into technology and deconstruct it all and turn all of those BTUs, the energy units inside the garbage, into gas. And we're going to separate each of the types of gas. And we're going to remix them together, make our own propane. And we're going to run generators and the garbage will disappear and we'll make more electricity than we used making it disappear. That is it's a great idea, but no one thinks it's a good idea. And they got that thing to work. Didn't work all the time. So was Plasco a total success? No, but did it massively move the needle on science? So I would prefer to be involved with things that are that way and think about it, because otherwise you have to really be a historian and involve closely with the prior thing. I'm not really diligent that way. I don't want to do that.
No, you just move the needle.
Well, I would sooner just look at it and say, like, I was very surprised with cannabis, and I've been very, very surprised with psychedelics, how so many people are sure that it's a bad idea, but they don't know why. That should be like a massive calling to do something. Like, this is a really bad idea. I hate it. Well, why? Well, it's just a bad idea. I think that's obvious. Like, that line of logic, which is not logic, exists in many places. And I just, I think it's more interesting to find those pockets.
Were you always the type of person, the kid that always asked why? Like, parents said, you know, we need to get this. Were you going, why? I know you grew up on a farm. So is it, you got to go do these tours?
Yeah, I don't know that I ripped everything apart to try figuring everything out. But I think probably like most people who will listen to your stuff, you spend a lot of your early life trying to figure out why can't I do that? Why shouldn't I do that? And trying to comply. And then you get to a certain point in time where you don't feel like complying anymore and you do what the heck you want to do. And so for me, some of my early business endeavors were okay. Some were failures, some were successes, moderate. But I spent a lot of the time trying to make what I think, if I drew a picture of some of them, it would look like a platypus. Like, I've always loved the platypus. I think I did at least 2 speeches in public school on the platypus. And it's because if you take all these weird inputs and assemble them, you get a platypus. And in business, that means you have a really slow moving, got to be isolated, can't possibly survive in the real world on a highly competitive basis because you got this freaking mixture of weird stuff. And so a lot of my early business attempts were, oh, well, this person's very experienced. I should listen to them and do that part. And that person's very experienced. And I do that part, rather than saying I'll listen to them, but if I disagree, I'm not including it. And so now, like, I don't, I listen to a lot more people, but I don't include most of the things they say.
You mentioned something as you were talking, and it made me think of one of the stories. And I did a lot of reading before you sat in this chair, but I appreciated. And at Carleton University, you became president. You were president of the student association, which, especially at university, it's no longer a popularity contest. You were getting shit done.
Yeah.
But I love the fact that Terry Matthews was a board member.
Yeah.
And there was you mentioning that you rearranged the names on as to where people were sitting so that you had an opportunity to sit next to them. I think for any young entrepreneur, any young kid out there looking to make a difference, figure it out. You figured out how to have that conversation.
But and it wasn't that I was pursuing Terry because I knew what he did. It was really weird. So I took 6 years to do a 4-year degree. I have no clue why people are in such a rush. right? Like I had to explain.
Was it intended?
No, I just got involved. No, you're not in a rush. Like, you have to explain to your parents over and over again that it's an education, not a race. I don't understand what the big rush is. Like, you end up working for a long time. I don't understand why anyone would possibly want to start working before they're 25. Like, it's insane. Especially if 40.
Do you feel that way with your children?
For sure. I was like telling them, do not go to college, like take a gap year. And regrettably, the eldest one got into a program that was sort of prestigious and he refused to waive it. I'm like, who cares? You'll get in again. Take a gap year, take time. If you think about it, if 40 is the new 30, that means the 30 is the new, 15? So like, what's the hurry to get out there? I don't get it. So Terry, when I was on one of my things, I was on the board of governors with him. Board of governors is essentially the community governance people for the operation of the university budgets, et cetera. And I always felt like after I did it for 2 years and I didn't know what Terry did, but I knew you could just tell that he actually liked students. Now, you would think that anybody that would go on the board of governors of a university would like students, but it was not.
I wouldn't think everyone does.
No, I would say at least half of them.
Some of them are prestige. Some of them are resume.
I don't know. But like half of them, I always got the impression as a student that their view would be there would be a lot less problems with the university if it weren't for all the students. If you think about it, that is a bit of a problem. Like, why do they have a homecoming party and why are we getting all these complaints? Because they're students. And so Terry would, and still to this day, I have never met an entrepreneur who has more regard and more interest in constantly bringing students in. He's amazing. I don't think he's still doing it, but like he almost turned his house into like student housing for people who were from outside of the community who would work in his companies and reside and take up space in his place. Like he does everything he could to get students into businesses and have them stay and grow and work with it. And like when you look around, Terry, there are people now who are students, but like 30 years ago or more who are still working in his network of companies. And so I moved to sit near him because I was a student and I had no clue what he actually did. Just read the people, enjoy it. Like one of the things there's a certain amount of me that's good at emotional intelligence and there's a certain amount of me that's extremely bad at it. I did not understand empathy. This word empathy, I don't think I understood what it meant until I was at least mid-40s.
That's a long time to right. Understand or appreciate that word.
Right, but I did understand. I could see where people were going and I could see what was motivating them, but to actually be able to experience and take your feelings and have them become mine. Like if you were really particularly sad about a particular thing and really transfer to me, I didn't always get that. But I always understood what I could see if you were at something, kind of what was your agenda? Where were you really going with this? And so I think part of what is good to take your time and get involved with a lot of stuff is you don't get locked into one place, one model, one set of culture. And if you jump into a business and suppose you ended up at Uber and you worked at Uber for 10 years and you started that when you're 22, that culture will be the imprint on you. And it's not historically been a great culture. It's improved quite a lot under the new guy. So I think it's better that people do a bunch of things so that they actually generate or develop almost like cultural training by moving around.
I was 20 years with the same company.
Yeah. Well, look at you. You're a mess.
No, but it's amazing to see, you know, like, honestly, my mind was blown when I really learning now being out of it was in. So I lived in a bubble and I had no idea that I was in a bubble until I wasn't in the bubble anymore. And to see the world and what was out there was astonishing to me. It was fascinating.
It's hard too, because there's when you were where you were before, you knew where the coffee was or the pencils were, or the washroom, the who's in charge, how's this work, everything was, you knew. I can see why people don't love change because change is hard. You know, it's when I left Canopy, I had 4,500 people that I was being their leader and I could tell that I had to sever 4,500 connections. And, you know, obviously they weren't all equal, but you feel that. And in your case, you had tens of thousands, and I have no idea, but you had a lot of people who on a morning, daily basis knew you. And you stopped that. And for them, it would be something different. And for you, it was something different. Mm-hmm. But it will have a long tail with you compared to them. Because what my case is, when you get a new CEO, then the people can attach them. When they get a new hostess or host, absolutely, they can attach them. You have to figure out who the hell you are.
It's amazing that you put it that way. It's so true. I probably should have practiced it a little bit more. You've had a little bit more practice at it than I have. And I think you've snuck into different environments. And I don't mean snuck into companies and stuff, but you've been able to maneuver yourself and have an energy and bring this experience with you to so many different levels of business without always knowing exactly. Like, I don't think you knew all of the research that you know about cannabinoid and everything. Now you've learned and you've been open to it.
Yeah. Listen, I think when I graduated from Carleton, I used the phrase, I was a very enthusiastic generalist. I continue to be a very enthusiastic generalist, which means, if I were expert in something, I could sit here and pontificate on it. As an enthusiastic generalist, what you have to do is go and absorb it, go participate. And I've found that there's tons and tons of money out there that has no clue what to do. There are a lot of really, really smart people who, doesn't matter if it's in my software life, they can have like undergraduate from Waterloo or a master's, a PhD in computer programming. They can be brilliant at like creating, all kinds of mathematical structures. But they don't know the question to answer. What am I making for whom? And so if you can focus these things in, there's always an opportunity to be in charge.
Because you could do that. You could figure out. I feel like you could figure out the why.
Well, you
left that out. And for me, the why is a big component to it.
I think so. But I grew up on a farm. We had a big garden. I said, I'm never having a garden when I grew up. Now I have a garden. But I don't really do the garden. And I think the way I do the garden is very similar to the way I do businesses. What it is I partitioned an area, put a little fence around it, put a bunch of soil in it, rototilled it, and said, now you guys can all plant it. And so Heather and the boys had to plant it every year, but I made the garden. So did I actually make the garden? No. But I would say that I initiated the environment in which a garden was created.
It was the foundation.
Right. And so I do that every time in business. And then people say, what a great garden. I say, yeah, I made it. But no, I don't take all the credit, but I'm saying, I think that is the way I participate in creating things is to create an environment which they can occur, but I don't make them occur.
But you have built some amazing foundations
Some
uniquely strong foundations that most people don't even get that far. And not only were you able to do that with Canopy Growth, like Tweed into Canopy, but with the technology company, with Martello, you're doing it with Ruckify. You're building, you're getting in as it's when the foundation needs to be laid.
Yeah, I think it's much
and letting
easier.
Everybody else plant what it is that they'd like to put in there.
Yeah, I don't understand why anybody's unhappy about getting older. It's easier to do all these things the more you've done. And so like Ruckify started out of an extremely obvious circumstance. But now as of Friday, this thing's, we just raised about $7.5 million so we keep going. What it simply does is it's really bad for the environment in the world. If we all own everything, even if we need to use it, can't we find a way to share it? So for example, you have holidays coming, you may have guests to your place tonight. You know, there may be fasting and then tomorrow there may be another meal. Do you need a mix master? Maybe. Do you need to own it for the rest of the year? For sure not. Do you need, now that the leaves and the acorns are falling, to clean your eaves trough? Yep, got to do that. Do you need a ladder? Yep. Do you need to own a ladder? No. And it goes on and on and on. You know, you keep working out. Eventually, I hope you don't get it, but you'll have an injury. When you have an injury, do you need a brace? Yep. Then do you need a treadmill at your house for recovery if you didn't already own one? Yep. Do you want to own a brace and a treadmill for that circumstance? Nope. Just need to use it. So the whole point of it is that there's a global inventory of things that are all local that can be delivered to your house with Uber or Lyft that you need for a period of time and a purpose. And then you want Uber and Lyft to take them away. And you don't want to own them, but you're happy to rent them. And you don't want to go through all the nonsense of going to places that rent this or that. You need to simply have access, use, and get rid of it. And so Ruckify is all about, how do we translate that into a software application that knows where you are, knows how much Uber will be, how to get it there, and open it up in about 50 cities by the end of the year.
So how much is the technical programming side, and how much is the the concept of selling and getting people in a network together, because they're very two different sides of the business.
And if you do one well and not the other, you're dead. Mm-hmm. So they both have to be done really well, which means you have to have both parts of your brain working on it. One is about how do I create an inventory of things? And there's a whole three-step process by which inventory is built from most costly to least costly. And then there's a whole technical thing about like, well, suppose you were getting something bigger than a Mixmaster. So a Mixmaster would fit terrifically in the back of an Uber. What if you needed a kayak? That doesn't go in the back of an Uber. What if it was really heavy? And I've ruckified things like a small digger and a bobcat. That for sure does not fit in an Uber. So you have to, in the technology platform, say, what is this and what category does it land in when you load the inventory so you know what way to have it delivered? And so these little things, as you think them through, matter a lot. Because if you send an Uber to pick up a small bobcat, that will be a waste of everyone's time. And so I would say it's technology and it is society execution. But if you do it right, I think environmentally, all the things that we have made for us that we seldom use are far worse for the environment than mostly the houses and cars we live in and transport with. Like, where did your power washer that's sitting in your garage used seldom come from? Bits and pieces from all over the world digging holes and using petroleum-based products fashioned in a coal electricity-driven facility in China, put on a ship, sent across the ocean, put in a cardboard box, brought to your store, sold to you, you drove it home in your car, and that occupies space so you need a bigger house. On the surface, that sounds extraordinarily selfish and dumb. It is. I have a beautiful power washer that we should network together because I have not yet used it this year. I use my ladder for about 10 minutes. My acorns are out of my eave trough. Might use it one more time this year, and then that ladder will sit on the wall for every day and every minute of the year. So there's something that makes a lot more sense, and that's Ruckify.
At what point do you tend to realize that it's working, that the two systems are going are working and it's going to take off?
Well, we spent the better part of several years and many millions of dollars, 12 methods of trying to go to market to figure it out. And once you figure it out, it was just the beginning of July and we knew we had it. But you can't be, where a lot of businesses fail is they conclude they're right, they put all their money onto that bet, and if they're wrong, they run out. What you have to do is actually do a bunch more patient tests and trials and methods, and the combined sum means that you actually figure it out. But I've never actually found that there's one thing you do that the way you began is the way you finish if you're successful.
So you were incredibly successful. I know that there were some changes in management, in ownership, and companies that were no longer in Canada but were worldwide. When you got in July,
terminated.
Because people tried to put it nicely. People tried to be like, step down. And you were like, hell no. I was fired.
Well, but I think, you know, stepping down and all this stuff, it's almost like people, like, unless you were caught stealing a lot of money or something, why are you embarrassed when you leave a business? Especially if you didn't want to leave. So I just, I don't understand that. So why would you not explain it? And then do it in a way that the company looks positive and you look positive. So basically what happens is when you grow companies very rapidly, tech companies, startups, what you're fixated on is creating a team who are aligned. And you'll spend all the money you can get to create the infrastructure so that team can create great products and you can begin to acquire customers and show growth. And you don't worry about, like, how long is the building going to last? How do I amortize it? You don't worry, like, if you come to work, everybody who came to work with us, I gave them stock equity, meaning they got a portion of the company at the price it was the day they arrived. And if we all worked really well together, it would go up. And that is, in my opinion, a very good thing. And that's how a lot of tech companies work. But what it creates is an accounting view that that's costly, because the difference between the price I gave you the stock at and the price it is in the future in accounting worlds looks like a liability. I don't think so. I think accounting's wrong. I think it should look like an asset. Because if I gave you stock and you came to work with me and I hired you and you were dumb and the stock went down, that's not an asset. It's everything's wrong. And so what you'll find is companies that are growing aggressively, that are oriented to sort of scale, have nothing in common with big old companies that make a lot of profit. Because what happens is when you run a big old company, it doesn't matter if it's pharmaceutical, tobacco, booze, whatever, they don't have any growth. They have almost a steady state business that gives them if they sell $8 billion or something, they get a billion or two of profit. But next year, they might sell $7.8 billion or $8.2 billion, and they'll still get a profit. Where high growth companies, I don't care if it's Amazon or a Google or a Shopify or a Canopy, what they're trying to do is just keep ramming up in terms of revenue and taking over the world. And so those, the way you govern and measure and all of these things are completely mirror opposite. And I now know that for sure. But I think it's not a, it's never usually a personality thing or a big company, little company thing. It's usually accounting. Like if you looked at the whole world and said, what causes most changes, it comes down to accounting, and accounting comes down to shareholder alignment. And there are many different types of shareholders in the world. Some want like it never to go down. It doesn't have to grow much. Some want things to double every year. And so those shareholders have nothing in common, and they all rely on accounting and the way the business is governed.
It allowed you to be able to tell people that you weren't retiring. Yeah. You weren't tired. There's a ton of energy still to go. And so I look at you and you're vibrant and you've got this energy about you. And yet at the same time, you've been raising two boys. You're traveling the world. I mean, yeah. Just even looking at your schedule, I really like your assistant, by the way. It's like trying to like manage all this stuff. Like how do you do it? How does one, because I'm often hearing now, you know, like you have the Gary Vaynerchuk's and it's like you're hustling and you're doing this, but to enjoy life, could you enjoy the life that you were building while it's happening? Like, are you able to not take the meeting in New York or have to fly to London and have to do things? Like, where's no, the perspective on all of it?
I would say I'm pretty bad at like that part. So one of my board members who's about 85 now, who grew up in Glace Bay, Nova Scotia, which is not home of prosperity, lives in Toronto, made himself, at times he's been a billionaire. So he's currently several hundreds of millions of bucks. He said, Bruce, and he still comes to work every day.
At 85.
Yeah. Loves doing deals, works on stuff, thinks long-term. I've talked to him at least twice a week. He said, the problem is if you grew up without a ton of money and you had to hustle for your first buck, you have no clue what to do with money. And so the reason my kids are good is my wife looked after them mainly. We had a deal like, I didn't really know that I like kids. I like my own kids. I probably don't even know if I would like other people's kids much, but she was really in charge. So for example, there was a very brief time where one of them was at daycare, but she agreed that she would stay home with him and stuff like that. And by doing these things, it meant that I would come and go and be there. But I was coming and going a lot, right? Like, and still am. Like I just looked at Bonvoy is the merger of Marriott and Starwood.
And hotels.
Hotels. And they have this application which tells you, you know, how many nights you've stayed. And I'm lifetime their best view of a customer. So they call that titanium for life, meaning whenever I arrive, they love me and they upgrade me to the best room they have. And the reason they do that is I had 10 years where I never had less than 50 nights in their hotels. 10 years. And this year, somehow, because I got super busy trying to figure out what was next this summer and I was busy all the beginning of the year. Last week, I stayed my 96th night at a hotel. And that is not a really good thing. But it's necessary if you're going to go places and see people and they're not in Ottawa.
Okay. Do you mind if I go dig a little bit deeper? Would your son say that? That, you know, that you're titanium membership has the same value of being out and about. Like I'm trying to find the balance because so many people are racing. They're in this race to do something or have more things or have more. Like, is there a balance or no?
No, I would say that over time I tried to learn how to be very present when present, and I tried to always be back on weekends and go stuff. But like, if you're going to try and build a global company, you should try not to live in Ottawa. And it's because how do you get from Ottawa to, say, LA? Well, you fly to Toronto. How do you get from Ottawa to, say, Madrid? Well, you fly to Toronto. So right off the bat, you're going to have sometimes where you can't do that in the right time. So you end up flying to Toronto, staying in a hotel at the airport in Toronto. Why? So you can get on a plane the next day early on to go to where you wanted to be. So now you've just had an extra flight and an extra overnight. So one of my activities has been to push that, you know, we're the nation's capital. We're very happy. We have 1 million people now here. How about we have planes that go places that you want to go versus going to a place you don't need to go before you get to the place you want to go?
Have you been at my social dinners? Oh my gosh.
No, but it's in a quite an absurd situation. I would say that probably I spent 20 plus years like a lunatic hamster and just going to make things happen. And now that things have happened,
you're still.
I don't know what. Someone tried to get me to play golf this summer, and I almost did. I don't really want to do that.
So you don't feel like you're passing up on things that you wish you were doing. Okay, so I come from a health and wellness and fitness, mm-hmm. and take the time for self care. Like, do you have self care? Do you sit to 5 minutes to breathe and to meditate? Do you go and keep your heart kind of going? So with all this pressure that it's going to be withstanding it and go for a run, like what have you done? Like, have you given yourself any leeway?
Well, I like going to a class on Saturday at the Good Life and a class on Sunday. And I like, if I'm here, which I haven't been at all, to play hockey on Tuesday evenings. But I pace a lot. I walk a lot. Like when I'm on the phone where I'm doing everything, I'm going that way. But I think...
Do you see pacing as just good physical activity, or do you see it as an anxiety release of phone calls and business calls that you're making while you're pacing on the phone?
I find all of the above. I find that when you're moving around, it's much easier to think. And if I have one of those apps that tells me how many steps, it was always a lot of steps, but it's sort of that stuff. But no, I think, I always joke that with the crew at Canopy, it was a very hardworking place. And stress is often a perception thing, right? Like, oh my God, that we're so lucky. We have this island all to ourselves, possibly forever. This is going to be amazing. Or shit, I'm stuck on a deserted island. One's stressed out, one's not. And so I find stress in business 100% not when you're going fast. It's when you're decelerating, when the phone stops ringing, when the cash account gets lower. That's stress. Stress is not growth. I don't think there was any stress really in that. There was some pretty crazy times. Mm-hmm. But there were crazy times in the context of getting something quite interesting done.
Like an exciting, like it's sure. an excitement. It's almost like you're about to go on this roller coaster.
Yeah, is a roller coaster stressful? Well, no, it is if all of a sudden you come over the hill and you realize, shit, the track fell down. There's no track. We're dead. That would be stress. But if it's just whoop, 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 that's fun. I don't know. I don't think I had stress in creating it until we changed the board. And then you have stress because you're at odds with accounting. I think a lot of stress is perception.
It's interesting, though. I think a lot of people wish that they could enjoy the roller coaster, knowing that the track is probably not going to fall off at the other side, right? And to enjoy the ride, except how long sometimes
you never know. Enjoy the crisis.
I think people are scared of expiry dates.
Yeah, enjoy the crisis. You have no clue when the next one's coming, right? It is, I think that's the only way you should be in business. Otherwise, you should not be running a business if you don't enjoy the crisis. Like I quite like the fact that my phone largely only received problem calls. You know, people call you during the day to say, you know what, we told you we were going to get done today. We got done. I'd be like, why the hell are you calling me? That's what you're supposed to do. What you want to have is when they call you, say, well, you know what, we're going to get done today. Didn't happen. And it didn't happen for like these five bad reasons. That's actually the point of the phone call.
What a great tip for entrepreneurs and for business people.
If you don't like bad news, don't lead, because eventually they won't bring you the bad news and you know why you die, because you didn't know the bad news. Kills you.
Leadership, is that how
you see it?
I mean, because you talk about Terry Matthews, right? There's mentors, there's people that you've looked up to. What do you consider to be under yours, the leadership?
So I'm not a particularly excellent manager. And I say that in that if you were working, suppose you directly reported to me, I'm supposed to give you an annual review. I'm supposed to sit with you for like an hour one day and go through a bunch of categories and discuss your performance against KPIs, these key performance indicators. I think that's all absolute nonsense. And the only reason we do it is because we all went to public school and we used to get report cards. And then you're supposed to bring a report card home every year or every couple of months and all this nonsense. It should be super binary. You interact all the time and everybody knows exactly where you stand. And it's really clear that if I was interacting with you and I never wanted to give you any more stock equity because you're pissing off, you're incompetent, you're not doing the job, then I'm doing you a disservice by keeping you there because I'm never going to give you upside. So we should have a talk and you should leave. I think that is a more effective review process. And so I don't like doing that kind of other stuff. Mm-hmm. And I understand the merits of it for a lot of places, but I think that's almost a crutch for an absence of direct skill feedback. And so I feel like my job is I'm a leader, and leaders are different than managers. But if you have a whole bunch of managers and no leader, you have a problem. If you have a whole bunch of leaders and no manager, you have a bigger problem.
You've been very good at figuring that out.
It now, took a while.
Right. Can you even count the amount of boards? I couldn't quite figure them all out. The charities. I mean, even the Nepean Skating Club. Who skated?
Who skated?
Okay.
But here's the problem with being an
entrepreneur. I saw that. I'm like, there was a kid that skated.
So I had a kid skating. Yeah. And the thing was quite historically prestigious. It had achieved quite a lot of things in the past, but it didn't appear likely to have much of a future. And the reason is that it had to automate, meaning make this thing easier to be a client. How do I sign up? How do we get coaches? And so sitting in the side rather than bitching, he said, well, I'll be president for a year. So I don't know. I think I was president for a couple of years and we made a lot of changes. And to the best of my knowledge, the place is operationally sound at this time. But it's like I became the chair of the public school parents council for like the grade 7-8 school, which was a complete, like it was an insane use of my time. But I had this view that I didn't agree with the interaction with the then principal and the parents being so collegial because I thought the person was doing a bad job. Like I don't want an explanation of why it's okay to suck at math at that school going down, that it's because we let in, you know, we're more open to people. And so I'm like, no, the deal is if you're going to bring more people in, you have to have tools to make them succeed, not an explanation why it sucked. And so like I spent a year. And the bad part is I sucked in a couple other people to help me who ended up there for like 3 or 4 years.
So Bruce approaches you about being on a board now that you're going to be, actually doing things.
But those boards, frankly, I thought were more productive uses of time than many corporate boards. I don't like corporate boards. I think corporate boards have become a fashion show. And I think fashion shows and corporate governance actually turn the board into a hierarchy. They're actually in a situation where as part-time people working maybe a day a quarter, have authority above the entrepreneurs. I don't get that for any growth company. The entrepreneurs should be in charge. They should be supported and they should be fired if they turn out to be dishonest or incompetent. And the board only does one thing. It's make sure the right person's running it, and if they're not, fire them. After that, they're a review authority, not a direction authority. And I've always thought that. If you worked at a company 1 or 2 days a month, how could you be, even if you're an expert in the topic of last decade, I don't think you have any capacity to actually be a leader. And so I think this whole governance and board thing has become overdone. It's prestige.
I know, but I do appreciate that you've joined on to boards and joined into things because you needed changes to be made. Whereas most people would have just been like, oh, just let it go. It'll change next year or something else. Or our kids are going to be out of the system. Who cares? Our kids are done that school next year.
Yeah.
And that's the difference between the doer and what you have created and done and the rest of us who sit back and kind of go, I wish, and don't ever do anything like that.
Well, it was embarrassing once because somebody at some place for an award or a speech or something introduced me and they read everything from the time I was on student council. I was like, there's some mental issue here. Cause it gets to be a very long list. And it's not that I do it because, oh, that will look good. It's you get involved because you got to get it done. Like I became president of the Students Association, not because I thought that would look good. I became president in part because when I was in first year, there was a guy with red hair who was this small guy and he was in the bar called Oliver's and he was clearly drunk and disruptive, but he didn't get thrown out. And I found out that he was the student union president. And I concluded that might be a good job for me. And so through a progression of things, it turned out that I became the president. You know what I didn't do? I didn't get into the political part. What I thought was we should materially increase the budget we spend on all the first year students in their first week. Because I believe if you go to a place like a university, and if in the first week you get fully engaged and connected, I think you probably multiply the probability of that person concluding their time at the school and loving it. And it's all about that old saying.
Community.
Yeah, but it's like that saying that if you have a great start, you're half done. And so that was my big push.
Okay.
We spent a fortune on orientation.
So where are you investing your big start right now on this great start that you're going to have a long run? Because you've got a number of things on the go.
Well, so I've invested in and I'm working with a company called MindMed. That's a psychedelics company. I've invested in and I'm helping a company called, it's essentially the Better Dog Food Science. So it's BTTR Dog. And it's basically buying a whole bunch of companies which do direct-to-consumer dog food products so that we can then overlay research, give clinically established cannabinoid strategies incremental to a great business. I invested in a thing called Gage Cannabis in Michigan because Michigan is a state in the U.S. that has currently regulated medical only. January 1st, it goes medical and rec. It's a big state with really good rules. So I think if a company can succeed and be very powerful there, it'll give them a great cash flow engine to go anywhere else in America or the world. So I'd like that one. I invest in a thing called Slang, S-L-A-N-G, which takes in the four quadrants of cannabis from medical to vape, brands and product technologies, and puts those into the hands of entrepreneurs who are producing cannabis for sell-through. So that if you're in one state, you can get the same thing in every other state. And so it gives a continuity of a consistent product and a consistent technology. So I like that because I think over time, people are going to quit saying CBD and THC. And they're going to want outcomes. Then they want to know an outcome based on a package and a product name. So I'm involved with that. Involved now a little bit with a venture capital firm out of France. Because I think that 3.0 and maybe 4.0 of cannabis are going to come from European researchers where they have better even access to cannabinoids and federal government work. So that's where I want to see that out of.
Okay, so you just mentioned, like, I think it was 5 or 6.
Yeah.
How many things are landing on your desk?
Oh, I've looked at a couple hundred.
Oh, my God.
In fact, I was sitting outside your building talking to some nice people about their plans for hemp in America. And it was a good plan, but there are too many good plans that aren't sufficiently advanced to actually become businesses. I would sooner be involved with somebody that went forward, fell backwards a bit, needs to go forward again. Because then you can actually be helpful. Because until someone falls backwards a bit, I don't think they really understand the challenges. And therefore, they don't know how to be helped or have assistance.
So I just looked at my watch and I got to get you out of here in a couple of minutes. If you can, top three things, if you don't mind. Like if there was like Bruce's top three things you live by, do you think you could easily come up with a list for me?
A few. So I think part of the thing that's really important is if you're doing anything, if we're going to work together, if I'm going to have an association with people, I have to have three things. I can't give you energy. If you don't have energy, then there's no way we can collaborate. We can't do things. So I look for energy. If you don't have integrity, I can't keep track of the money, the details of everything. So like if you're actually trying to take before everybody makes, can't work with you. And IQ, I don't need geniuses. And I understand that not everybody is one and there's an appropriate place for everybody to work. But if I'm actually going to try and collaborate and create value with somebody, they're going to have IQ. So if they got energy, integrity, and IQ, and this is a list a guy named Michael Leachin had made and I agreed with and we went through and talked about in depth what they mean. Those are three things that I think for going forward, it doesn't matter if you're going to have relationships with people, they have to have those three things. And a relationship can be a business, it can be your home life, but they got to have all those three things. Otherwise, how the heck do you work?
Was there an author? Was there a book? Was there anything that triggered some of this mindset?
You know, what's really weird is I read a lot of things, but they're usually legal documents, as thick of things as The Economist. But I don't read books. I talk to people a lot. I ask them a lot of questions. And so like I don't know when people read books. Like I have no idea when you would read them. I don't find there's any period of time in the day where I'm going, man, I wish I had a book because I got like an hour and a half. I want to read a book. So I really feel bad that I don't read them. I think the last book I might have read carefully was A Prayer for Owen Meany. And I keep thinking maybe I'm Owen Meany.
I'm thinking I'm going to call the hotel chain and then maybe when they see you check in,
they
have
book.
Like a bedtime goodnight book for Bruce.
But that'd be like 12 words, 12 words and sleep.
depends on what product you took to help you actually sleep, which goes in with a number of the products. I think you've done an amazing job. I'm in awe of the mindset, of the vision that you carried, and I think the way you're inspiring a lot of other people to go about business. It's really quite fascinating. So people can find your latest projects. I know Rockify is the big one. Congratulations.
I have a website called brucelinton.com. It's not super hard. Where I'm trying to keep people signed up and put the projects that I'm working on so that people can dig into them and see if they like them.
Oh, perfect. Okay. Yeah. So that's what comes with kind of being behind the brand. You become your brand, Bruce.
You gotta be.
Yeah. BruceLinton.com if you're looking for more information. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. That is a wrap on Living Your Life with Leanne Lang. Please like, share, subscribe, comment. It's been great to see the growth of the podcast, but it's always great to have guests like Bruce being able to inspire people, not only in the health and wellness, but really in entrepreneurship, in mentorship and leadership, which is something that affects each of us each and every day. Have a great one, everyone.
What happens when we play outside? We become healthier, both mentally and physically. We become more creative and more focused. We connect with nature, each other, and ourselves. Let's Take This Outside, a new podcast hosted by me, Marianne Iveson, an aspiring outdoor athlete and nature lover. I speak to athletes, outdoor professionals, and scientists about their connection to nature, how it affects their performance and everyday life. Let's Take This Outside, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts, and at ivisonvoice.com/podcast.